broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
We called upon them in the day of our trial, when volunteering has ceased, when the draft was a partial failure, and the bounty system a senseless extravagance. They were ineligible for promotion. They were not to be treated as prisoners of war. Nothing was definite except that they could be shot and hanged as soldiers. Fortunately, indeed, it is for us, as well as for them, that they were equal to the crisis. And the grand historic moment that comes to a race only once in many centuries came to them, and they recognized it. Norwood Penrose Hollowell, 1892, Colonel, 55th. Massachusetts Infantry. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We're talking about the slaves who served in the Union Army during the Civil War, and particularly those who went to serve from the Delmarva Peninsula. My guests are retired Salisbury University history professor Clara Small and genealogist Teresa Neal. Because of his particular interest in Black history, I've also asked Delmarva Public Radio news director Don Rush to join our discussion as well. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a general discussion of African Americans in the Union Army. It's my understanding that nearly 200,000 African Americans fought in the war, and they were first deployed in 1862 along the coast in South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida. Before the end of the war, 178,000 blacks served in the Union Army. Clara, let me begin with you, if I might. Were the slaves readily welcomed into the Army in 1862?
Definitely not. Nor were free blacks welcomed into the Army. It was not until after the Battle of Antietam that the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. Now, that was the first one. That was in 1862, September, and President Lincoln gave the Southern states in rebellion, precisely 100 days before the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect on January the 1st, 1863. And even after that, it was a fight for free blacks to even become a part of the fighting forces.
Well, who were these slaves that joined the Union Army? Where all did they come from? Oh. And Don, you can join in on this as well.
All over. They were from some of everywhere. New York, southern states. Some were fugitive slaves. They came from everywhere.
As a matter of fact, it was in the Massachusetts governor who was an abolitionist, and he formed one of the first militias. And the composition, Frederick Douglass, and its composition came from all over. It wasn't just in Massachusetts; it was across the country, as it were. So that there was this emphasis, particularly as you move towards what you hinted at as a declining problem with the number of white soldiers that were coming into the military. Of course, the problem was Lincoln needed soldiers. On the other hand, he didn't want to alienate the border states. So he held off as long as possible. He didn't initially go ahead and say, have these soldiers in there or try to bring them in. But as the war progressed, and as the war needs occurred, he began to finally turn to the idea that, yes, we need to bring these people in. Now, obviously, it coincided also with the Emancipation Proclamation, which had a great deal to do with keeping England out of the fight and the French out of the fight altogether. But these events sort of coincided together to produce this opportunity for African Americans to participate in the Union Army.
And the Emancipation Proclamation was military strategy and diplomatic strategy. But at the same time, think in terms of the state of Maryland. Maryland never did satisfy enough soldiers, never did fill the quota. And Lincoln had to play politics with those border states, Delaware and especially Maryland. Otherwise, if Maryland had seceded and Delaware had seceded, but especially Maryland, the Confederacy would have surrounded D.C. So we're talking about playing politics, hard.
Yeah, it was very hardball politics that Lincoln was playing at this very moment, as he had to. But one of the interesting things I ran across was that there was an earlier 13th Amendment that was proposed, and it actually would have allowed the slave states to keep their slaves. This was right before he was coming into office. The secessionists said, no, we don't want any part of it. And, of course, the Civil War was the result. And the 13th Amendment actually was, of course, implemented was to free the slaves. The irony is that if the South had decided to go ahead with Lincoln and accept the 13th Amendment, slavery probably would have existed for many, many years beyond the Civil War.
Yes. So when they came in, and I understand that African Americans fought in the Revolutionary War.
Every war and every conflict that occurred in this country.
And then what happened after the Revolutionary War? There was some kind of law passed that wouldn't allow them to serve in the military any longer?
Oh, yes. There were restrictions. There was fear. I mean, are you going to, as a slave, and you have not been granted your freedom, you have not been promised freedom, are you going, and if you still have that, those guns and ammunition, are you going to turn them against your owners if you are still a slave? That's a big question. And that's why a lot of slaves were taken out of the country by the British. And with the British, we're talking about Nova Scotia, Africa, England, and Canada.
And so the law clearly was changed in order to let them into the Union Army, and that was around 1862, I believe.
The start of 1863.
And again, the great comment was that that these people won't fight. That
was the belief, but it proved to be incorrect. If you promise your freedom, and you're going to you will fight, because as a slave, you might have what you could say a good master, or a benevolent master, but everybody wants to be their own master. So that was a reason to fight.
So I want to ask you in just a moment the role that that the African Americans played in the army. I mean, fighting clearly was one of them. There were other roles that they played, but to get at that a little bit, say something about the nature, do it this way. Remind us of what the nature of slavery was. What was slavery like?
Well, slavery depended upon many things. One, location. Were you in a border state, middle Atlantic, northern, southern? Location meant a lot. The local laws, state laws, federal laws. But it also meant who who were the masters? There were kind masters, and there were kinship ties between individuals, and didn't have to be blood ties. It depended upon the individual owners. Was he kind to his slaves? Did he treat them basically humanely, or was he very harsh? And if he was kind, what about his neighbors? How did his neighbors perceive him? What were his religious beliefs? Was everything dependent upon the well-being of his family, totally dependent upon slavery? So slavery depended upon time. It depended upon location. It depended upon all of the individuals involved. So you can't make a blanket statement about slavery. There were some very harsh slaveholders, but there were some who were not that harsh. So it depended upon so many different factors and the religious beliefs of the individuals. So it's hard to say unless you pinpoint it in terms of time, in terms of location, and the individuals involved.
And also, there's this. We tend to think about this in terms of simply being free. But slavery wasn't just about simply being free. It was a very suffocating lifestyle. I mean, 12 years a slave was probably one of the best things that was ever written. It really comes home the idea that, for example, if you, for instance, you had a quota of, say, cotton, and you picked X number of bales, your fear was twofold. One is that you would not make your quota, which meant it could mean punishment. On the other hand, your fear was that you would go above your quota. If you went above your quota, you would then be the new quota.
Yes.
And you worked like from before the sun
from
came
can
up.
To can't.
That's right. And to the into the evening. And that was your life for 6 days a week. I mean, this was not something you could take a break and have some fun or go out in the evening during the week that you worked. Only Sunday was there some kind of day off. So the idea is not just simply that this is about freedom, which it certainly was, but this was a suffocating experience for any human being, and for this group of people, extremely so.
And it also meant a difference between being a house slave and a field slave. If you were a house slave, the impression is, they were treated much better. But we're talking about 24/7.
That's right.
That's a big difference. So you have to qualify and quantify. It's not a simple thing.
One of the...
And there were some blacks who owned slaves, too. So let's not forget
there
that.
There were a few of those. That's right.
One of the things, though, that is general about slavery that I think very important is basically the lack of education. And to say something about the impact of just having no education and not being able to read, not being able to write in general, and what that means for a group of people.
Well, it meant no advancement. You could not have a job that would possibly benefit you, your family, nor your community. One of the best examples of that would have been Harriet Tubman. Harriet could not read nor write, but she escaped nonetheless because she had mother wit, common sense. She had been taught how to navigate the woods surrounded by her father. But she also knew how to take care of herself if she became ill from her mother. So that when she escaped in 1849 and she went to Cape May, New Jersey and Philadelphia, she could not get a very good job. She had to work on menial jobs because that's what she knew. And she saved the money. She came back to this area to help others. But still, she had to memorize the roots. She could not read. She could not write all of her life. And yes, she was taken advantage of by many people, even after the war was over, because she still could not read nor write.
So you've got 200,000 people, basically, who cannot read and cannot write. And yet, there were insurrections, there? And who were the leaders of these insurrections?
Those who could read and write, in most instances.
Right, and the other thing,
and they were a threat to the stability of the institution of slavery, especially if you knew how to read and write. Classic example, Frederick Douglass. remember when he escaped and he was supposed to have written a note and to help others escape? He was supposed to have eaten his, put it in a biscuit, so they couldn't, they had no evidence. But yet, who was suspect more so than anyone else? Frederick Douglass. And because he could read and write, he was in a better position than Harriet, who was also a slave. It made a big difference.
The other thing, too, is that if you allowed people to learn to write, they could write their own passes. They could forge. This was a security problem for those who owned slaves, because they didn't want their slaves to be able to write and then forge, say, papers. So as long as you keep them illiterate, then that you
control.
Keep them on. That's right, control.
Were there people who worked in the slave community to teach people to read and write?
But they had to do it secretively. Yeah, and many slaves who knew how to read and write had to keep it secret among themselves as well. Otherwise, they were going to be punished. There were some states that stated that you cannot teach a slave to read and write. If so, you would be punished. Frederick Douglass, owner's wife, when the husband came in and realized that his wife was teaching Frederick along with her son, he said, "You have to stop. You can't do that."
Well, for out of this community, 200,000 people joined the Union, the Union Army. They can't read, they can't write, they come out of abject poverty. What?
A lot of them could not read, not write. Okay.
Yeah.
No, majority. Well, do you have a sense, Clara, of the percentage?
No, it's hard to say because the figures, we don't have the stats
the
on that. We don't have that.
Right.
And even when we have some information about a lot of the individuals who served, it did not always say that they could read, that they were literate.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is this basic group of people, a large number of people, went into the Union Army. We know they fought. What were the basic roles that these people played in the Army?
At first, menial positions, not necessarily, even when they were recruited. Most of their positions were menial positions. They were they did the labor part of it. It wasn't that they were at first going to be able to fight, because the training was, should I say, not the best. And the presumption was they didn't know how to use guns, and they didn't know how to train, to march, and all of that. So at first they had menial positions.
And how did that change over time?
When you needed able-bodied, red, blood flowing in the veins soldiers, you needed them.
And they quickly found out that the colored soldiers became very good soldiers because they knew how to dig ditches already. They knew how to follow orders. They knew how to obey instructions. And they soon rose in the ranks. But only the ones who were educated to some degree achieved a level of an officer.
So how did they get formed into this group, get formed into fighting units? I'm assuming they were not integrated in the commands, that there were African-American groups and so forth. How did they get integrated?
Well, they really weren't integrated. The USCT were always separate. Always. Now, they had white officers, but we were talking about that. You were talking about that the other day. The units.
The units. There were 10 companies in a regiment. Each company consisted of 100 men, and each of those 10 companies formed one regiment, which would be 1,000 men. So as that regiment was filled, then they opened up another one. In some cases, they had to replace the person with someone who another recruit or another enlistee because one of the persons might have been transferred to the Navy because there was a lack of colored soldiers in the Navy?
Well, how was slavery different on the Delmarva, if it was at all, than in, say, Mississippi, Alabama, even Texas, Georgia, Florida?
Well, Barbara Fields, who's considered to be one of the outstanding writers in terms of slavery in Maryland, and she called it the middle ground. The middle ground between the North and the South. Maryland was not supposedly as harsh as it was in the South. The worst thing is to be separated from your family and to be sold South, to Mississippi, to Alabama. And when some slaves were rebellious, that's when individuals such as Curtis Jacobs and others had them sent there. It was harsh. And you never, and in most instances, you never heard or from them again. You didn't hear anything about them. You didn't know where they were. You didn't know if they were still alive or what.
And of course, one of the most famous of the slave traders, of people who got it, of course, was Patty Cannon.
Yes.
Who would pick up whoever she could find. If you were a slave, fine, that she would grab them, steal you, and then send you back south. If you were free, they would do the same. And they would do this by subterfuge, as a matter of fact. And, but the other interesting
and
thing
that's is... right here in
that's
this
area. Just right in this area, that's right. And you can go see her house. But the other thing, too, is that this was also an area that was mixed in terms of free blacks and blacks who were in slavery.
Almost equal.
Almost equal. And, you know, we obviously have the famous site, The Hill, which is probably the longest continuous free black community in the country, probably outdistances Treme in Louisiana. Yes. And so you had this very strange situation where, on the one hand, you had slaves. They interacted with free blacks, who obviously interacted with whites. And so they sort of had this sort of dance that they played with each other. And sometimes, if you were a slave, you would be a slave for the rest of your life, but you might be able to buy your way out. But if you bought your way out, that didn't necessarily mean that your children would be bought out. So you would have families where, for instance, you would have the children might be still in slavery while the parent had finally freed themselves and bought themselves out of slavery. So you had this very strange social mix going on the peninsula that made us, I think, I mean, obviously much different than, say, a place like Mississippi or even Alabama. It was that kind of middle ground.
Oh, yeah. Sam Green is the best example of that, the persecuted minister.
That's right.
Up near
East New Market,
and he was able to free himself, but not his children. And because the son escaped with Harriet Tubman's help to Canada, the daughter was sold away from the family. Even though she had a husband and children, they never knew where she went.
The story about Samuel Green.
Well, Samuel Green is a classic example of family members being separated from each other, whereby the father is free, and he tried to free his wife, but his children were still enslaved. And when his son, also named Samuel Green, was freed with the help of Harriet Tubman and was taken to Canada, and when the owner found out about it, Dr. Moose, he took this daughter of Samuel Green, sent her away, most likely down to Alabama or someplace or Mississippi, even though she had a husband and children. She was never, ever heard from again. So a father could be free and a mother could be free. It did not mean that the children would be free. Same thing with Harriet Tubman. Harriet's mother should have been freed at the age of 45 because of the Patterson will, but she was not freed. Harriet eventually had to get a lawyer to free her mother.
Well, I wanted to ask you what the significant battles were that African-Americans in the Union Army participated in. And did this dispel the sense that these slaves would not fight?
Oh, well, first and foremost would be the Battle of Petersburg. But I just recently read a quote from the 1st Maine Cavalry, who was at Appomattox Courthouse, and they did not think that the colored soldiers were going to come through, and they were thrilled when they came to rescue them from the rebel forces.
Chris, I'm not getting anything.
Okay, go ahead.
So that's two of the battles that I do know for sure. And, of course, there was Fort Pillow and Fort Gilmer and Fort Wagner.
Fort Wagner, yes.
Where the 54th Massachusetts in that famous movie Glory
yes.
fought. So there were several key battles that they participated in. But Petersburg was probably, and Fort Pillow, were the most devastating.
Well, I found this that I'd like to read to you in Melvin Drimmer's book on Black history, which I highly recommend, even though it was published in 1968. It's a significant work, I believe, anyway, and it's titled Black History, A Reappraisal, edited by Melvin Drimmer. And this is a comment written by Dudley Cornish, titled of the short piece is titled Even the Slave Becomes a Man, and the indication is when he's free he becomes a man. And this is Major General George H. Thomas. Gentlemen, the question is settled. Negroes will fight. This is the verdict pronounced by Major General George H. Thomas as he rode over the battlefield of Nashville in December 1864. And I think the African Americans' most significant battles were in 64 and 65, I believe, toward the end of the war. But he observed the bodies of colored men side by side with the foremost on the very works of the enemy. Thomas was neither the first nor the last Union commander to reach that verdict. So it seemed, and even with Lincoln, it seemed that the participation in these battles that you've mentioned dispelled any sense that these African Americans would not fight. And the sense, part of the sense being that a slave certainly will not fight, but a free man will fight. And a free man becomes a man. And will fight for his freedom. After the war, it seems that the blacks from the Delmarva came back to settle again back in the Delmarva. Is that accurate? Clara?
For the ones that we have observed so far that we found most dead, we don't know the percentage because part of the problem is that they said they were from Eastern Shore. So we cannot always pinpoint 100% of them belonging to Dorchester, Somerset, Worcester, or Talbot County. So most did return. Some did not. Some remained in other areas and settled there. But we're documenting where we know that they were born. And some are credited to some other states, what have you. But we think we've done a good job of this, trying to find out about these men.
Do we have a sense of why they came back?
And family.
And then what roles they played and what kind of employment, what kind of work, how was land redistributed when they returned?
Oh, gosh. Most came back for family.
Yeah, and the only way that they got land was to purchase it.
That's it.
So it wasn't like other wars where the veteran would get a bounty of land. So they would purchase it. Some of the guys did go away for a little while, and tracing them through the years, and some of them eventually came back. And not just the family, but the whole experience. Well, it was more like a community that raised each other.
Like Unionville,
yes,
for example.
And they had to support each other in their churches and in their work. And
to establish schools.
Yeah. And in some of the cases, they had to fight very hard to get a pension because African-American marriages were not acknowledged by the state, even though a white preacher may have performed the marriage. So they would have to have certain people in their community step up and give deposition to, yes, I saw these two married. Yes, these two lived together as husband and wife. So it was a struggle, but they had this community that they lived with, and they helped each other.
Yeah, they were vouching for each other and remembering the date and remembering when their children were born. Yeah, all of that. It coming back to a place that was familiar made a difference.
And it was basically an agricultural community.
Oh,
then
yes.
It's still an agricultural community today, quite frankly. So they came back to farm.
That is what their occupation was in most instances, or they were watermen.
Or they were sawyers, and yeah. The sawyers was a prized position because
yes.
You got paid a lot of money for that. So there was few and far between.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have some sawyers in the group.
So sawyers, they worked in the forest and
lumber.
And were in the lumber, mm-hmm. the lumber industry. When I drive down the Delmarva Peninsula particularly, I don't see any great forests. I see farmland. What kind of forests were extant
way
at
back.
That period?
Well, a lot of it has been cleared in order for farming now. And condos, but
tree farms still exist.
Yeah,
it still exists.
Far off the road, though.
Well,
off of 50.
Yeah, off of 50.
After the war, the reconstruction it took place. We're about 30 years, I guess, of the reconstruction activity. How did Reconstruction play out in general, and then how did it play out on the Delmarva and in Maryland?
Maryland was not reconstructed because it never left the Union. So you could not even apply that term to Maryland. What it was a series of laws that were passed locally and statewide, and Maryland had to change its constitution. And in 100 years for Maryland's Constitution, 150 years, I'm sorry, had to change its Constitution in order to basically say that blacks were free. So Maryland basically was not reconstructed.
One of the large issues of Reconstruction was, interestingly enough, voting rights. And were blacks allowed to vote In Maryland, free blacks, were they allowed to vote in Maryland prior to the war?
No, not really, because that was a major concern. Now, if you had a lot of property, it depended upon where you could vote. But in most instances, throughout the state of Maryland and in most states, no, blacks could not vote. Now, maybe in some, depending upon what elections they were involved in some northern states, yes, they could vote. But no.
And I'm assuming that became an issue in Maryland during Reconstruction?
Yes. You have to go by state, county by county.
The, what was it, I think, the 14th Amendment basically said that the state could not keep Negroes from voting. And that obviously was abrogated all across the South, and the right to vote was a huge issue. In on the Delmarva, are you aware of the struggle to vote here? As you said, county by county is the way it would go.
Okay, 13th, freed slaves, 14th, citizenship, 15th, right to vote. Now.
The 15th Amendment was the right to vote?
Mm-hmm. So if you look at Kent County as opposed to the Eastern Shore, it depended upon the impact of former slaves working with individuals in the community, like the GAR, Grand Army of the Republic, organizations that were formed to protect the rights of former veterans. Some GARs were formed throughout the state, but I think Kent County was maybe the most progressive. They recently, in the last, two or three years, restored the building that they had built during that time. But you have to look at each county and what was going on in each county to determine whether former slaves and free blacks had a right to vote. And you can't take it statewide. You've got to look at what was happening, because there were attempts to give blacks the right to vote, but yet it was systematically taken away as well.
In my reading, I saw that in Alabama and in Mississippi and other aspects of the South, a freedman. The Freedmen's Bureau. What was the Freedmen's Bureau, and what did it do?
First of all, it was supposed to protect the rights of newly freed slaves. It was supposed to also negotiate between former slaveholders and former slaves in terms of their work to protect the rights of former slaves who had purchased property. And sometimes there were faulty land deals because you could buy land, but after a period of time, you lost it. It didn't matter whether you had paid for the land or not. And to be accepted as citizens or what have you. So the Freedmen's Bureau did that. It also helped to establish schools, got teachers. It also had a Freedmen's Bank, which was very helpful in terms of information about former slaves, because if you deposited money into the Freedmen's Bank, and Frederick Douglass was the last president of it, you had to give a deposition as to who your parents were, and if you had children, if you were a former slave. So those are documents that help to document where individuals were or substantiate where they were. So it was helpful, but there were so few agents that it was ineffective.
That was underfunded. I understand.
Underfunded is not the word.
Yeah. The another aspect of Reconstruction that it seemed was very important was after the war, the churches particularly the black churches in the North, came south and provided significant help to the black community. Because, and help me here, Clarence, if I'm wrong, prior, the slaves generally sat in the balcony of the white churches. And the after the war, they were the gone.
Well, that's because...
And they had to form, they formed then their own churches.
Yes, it started before that, before the war. But they formed their own churches as a means of separation because it was a different form of religion as such. They wanted their own leaders. And they also formed their first schools. Most and many of the historically black institutions were formed at that time by soldiers coming back, not just the like UMES and other places, but the churches, the schools, their own institutions, something like the Masons and Oddfellows, what have you.
It's interesting to me that we mentioned education earlier and how important being able to read and write and just know where you are is through education. And that during Reconstruction, the first public schools were formed. And I'm assuming we owe part of that to the churches that that came south. You just mentioned that that they brought education
and leadership of the community too.
So I'm assuming it was money, it was education, it was organization and leadership that the black churches in the North brought south and helped with the whole Reconstruction period.
Yes. Well, you also have to modify that too, because a lot of white churches and white individuals were helping as well. It wasn't done solely by blacks, but a large number of blacks had also gone north to get an education, and they returned to the areas and they brought teachers and mostly women. And because, well, single women, not married women.
Did that happen on the Delmarva? Did you see growth in black churches on the Delmarva and the establishment of educational institutions as well here?
Usually you have a church, and as a part of that church, you had school, or school was just behind the church. Okay. Herschel Johnson's church up in
Christ Rock.
Christ Rock in Cambridge. And then also in East New Market, same thing. You have a church, you have a school.
Yeah.
Well, I thought that was, I thought, you know, we often hear that Reconstruction wasn't very significant. But well, in fact, It was an incredibly, it seemed to me, positive period in the South.
In many respects, yes, because education started there. If you look in places like North Carolina, schools were started there even before the land-grant colleges were formed around 1890. In many areas in Middle States, same thing. But some were started before that, but they didn't have that much following, funds, but they kept them going nonetheless.
And then the railroad car laws in Texas.
Plessis versus Ferguson.
In Texas, and the Jim Crow.
Right. Of course, I mean, the thing to remember is that Reconstruction ends around 1876 when the North makes the deal with the South. Okay, we're going to leave you alone.
The bargain of 1877.
That's right. In order to get the president into power, they made a deal, And for the next 100 years, a little less than 100 years, within the Democratic Party and in the Republican Party, the deal was struck. You can do what you want in your states. Obviously, slavery will not return, but we will have a coherent, single country, and you can do what you like. So that's one of the things that happens. What's fascinating is that you do get some growth, obviously, and a lot of activity going on during Reconstruction. But then that door begins to close, particularly after Reconstruction ends. It's after Reconstruction you start getting a lot of the Jim Crow laws, a lot of the peonage system that's created in terms of sharecroppers. Exactly. So that you get this shift that occurs in the South, and I would assume certainly in the peninsula as well, that there is a serious shift that occurs that then sets the pattern for the next 100 years. And one of the things I find interesting is that when you look at the debate that then begins, particularly post the post 1876, you now begin to get this debate about what is the best path forward for African Americans. Right? You have Booker T. Washington, who says, look, we got to build our economic power. We have to have our skills. We have to educate ourselves. That will gain us the power we need to then perhaps break into the political side, but at least gain its respect. And of course, W.E.B. Du Bois, this is this classic debate, says, looked around after Reconstruction, he looked around and he was disappointed by the lack of progress that African Americans had made, particularly in the South. He said, there's another element to this, and that's the political element, that unless you break into the political side of this thing, those political restraints will keep you from advancing forward. It's not simply enough to have economic activity, but that economic activity can be stifled. So you get this great debate that occurs within African-American thought coming out of this. Well, what is the best way to do this? And it's a debate that we hear echoes of today.
Yeah. Well, you really get to see it in 1895. 1895 is when Frederick Douglass dies. The next year, 1896, is when you have Plessy versus Ferguson.
Right.
1896, Louisiana, Mississippi Plan. The Mississippi Plan was that localities, the states can do whatever they want to, and you use the grandfather clause. If your grandfather voted in the election of 1860, you could vote. How many blacks could vote in 1860? They couldn't, okay? There's a literacy plan. There's a where you live plan, residence plan. You name it, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Down. Plessy versus Ferguson established separate but equal. That was not outlawed until May 17th, 1954, in the Brown versus Board of Education, Topeka, Kansas decision. May 17th, I remember that. That's my birthday, so remember that. So, but what I'm saying is that Reconstruction lasted a short period of time, ended with a corrupt bargain. Then on the heels of that, you have Plessy versus Ferguson, starting in Louisiana. Homer Plessy, who was 1/8 of a black man. He was a mulatto. But he took the case to the courts because he was kicked off of the train. And it kept growing and growing and growing and growing and stayed on the books until 1954.
Well, that, let me ask you before I ask you how that impacts us today and what we're looking at today. How did the Jim Crow laws and ordinances and regulations and attitudes play out on the Eastern Shore here?
Oh, God, it's still playing out in some respects.
Well,
it's playing out throughout the nation because of the racial climate that we have now. That has gotten worse. Jim Crow didn't start in the South. It actually started in the North. And why? Because with the great migration of blacks and former slaves and descendants of former slaves moving northward around before the 1920s or around that time period, the great migration.
First World War.
Yeah. Started moving northward. Individuals in the North had never been that close in such close contact with blacks. So they began to pass those laws that became known as Jim Crow laws. Those Jim Crow laws stayed in effect until Brown decision, 54, but on paper. But in effect, you can legislate laws, but you cannot legislate minds. And so it's still there in many respects. And the Eastern Shore, some people will say the Eastern Shore is about 50 years behind the times in terms of how people interact with each other on a wide spectrum. But it's not that severe because people are interacting with each other. But if you try to lump everything together, you say, oh, it's still in effect. You can't do that. You've got to look at how people interact with each other. But the problem is that there are laws, there are customs, mores, and traditions that some people don't want to get rid of. And racism still exists. We've seen that, God knows, more so lately. And it's not just racism, it's sexism. It's ethnocentrism. And the thing is, we will so far removed from the Civil War, over 150 years, that we should be beyond that. But the thing is, as long as we still look at a person in terms of color, in terms of their religious beliefs, in terms of sexism, we're going to still have Jim Crowism. Change the name and it's still, the game is still the same.
Of course, you have the great debates over the Confederate flag, yeah, and Confederate statues. The shootings last year, I think it was in South Carolina, certainly made a dramatic difference in terms of its politics, in terms of looking at the flag. Flag finally came down from the Capitol. Right. On the other hand, you still have debates about, for instance, Confederate statues. The most prominent one, of course, here in the Eastern Shore is the Talbot Boys. Yeah. I remember having a recent discussion about, well, why should it be there? And it was some white folks, and they didn't understand why perhaps it might not be a good idea to have that statue there. And also, the one thing to remember, by the way, but we have Frederick Douglass, which is at the library. Mm-hmm. But the thing to remember about the Talbot Boys, and a lot of those statues that were erected somewhere around the teens and the 20s. Mm-hmm. And this was a period when the nation began this sort of revisionist view of slavery and the South and the Ku Klux Klan. There's in the 1920s a prominent parade at the height of its power in Washington, D.C. So you get this revisionism that occurs in which, well, you know, it wasn't really so bad. I mean, that's really what occurred. And, of course, you have then President Wilson, who then decides he's going to segregate the military. So there's this period that we come out of, particularly with the Civil War, that basically there's a shift in emphasis and a shift in view of what the Civil War was about. So you have arguments about, well, it was about states' rights as opposed to, for instance, slavery, even though the vice president of the Confederacy, the South Carolinian secessionists, all said it was about slavery. That's what they said at the time. That's now been revised. So when we walk around, for instance, whether it's the Eastern Shore or other parts, I mean, it's not just the shore, there is a different vision of the way things are and history from whites as opposed to African Americans. That's why when I, for instance, I talk particularly to white people and I talk about the statue, they don't understand what it means. And
symbols.
And it's symbols, that's right.
Because history must be looked at from more than one point of view. If you solely look at it from one point of view, that's what you believe. If it is taught from solely one point of view, that's what the next generation is going to believe. But history takes into account different people, how those factors affect you. You can't teach it from solely one perspective. If you do, you're going to have fractured history. And that's what I call it. And when I teach African American history, I make my students understand, okay, well, I keep forgetting I'm retired. I walk into the classroom, I divide it. Okay, you're going to be a slave today. You're going to be a slaveholder. I can't be a slaveholder. I'm black. There were some black slaveholders. You should have read that here, your textbook, okay? I can't be white. I can't be a slave. I said, oh, yeah, yes, you are. Today you are. While we're having this discussion. And the next day I go in, I divide the class in a different direction because I want you to understand it. I want you to understand the effect it had on people. I want you to understand what was going on in the minds of the individuals, because that way you can teach it and teach it the way it should be. Because if I taught it solely from the perspective of being a slave, that's a disservice. If I taught it solely from the perspective of a slaveholder, that's also a disservice. And because of my background, I would be doing a disservice to my family's history as well. Because I'm a mutt, basically. Because my great-grandfather was white. And on my father's side, on my mother's side, my great-grandfather's descendants were from directly from Africa. And he used to say, walk as if you have some Guinea in you. Okay? And his wife, my great-grandfather, on my mother's side, was a direct descendant of slaves down in North Carolina. So I have the perspective of looking at it from different points of view. And that's what we must do when we teach history. Because otherwise, we're teaching fractured history. And if you understand it, try to understand it and how it affected different people, you understand history. And I have some people in class crying. I couldn't help that. But I wanted them to understand the impact of it. And they were better teachers as a result. And understood history better that way.
That's, Clara, a very moving statement from you. And I think it's significant. And it, and in addition to the teaching, it leads us really to say, you know, what do we do today? What are we looking at in terms of race relations and gender discrimination and gay and lesbian discrimination? And what do we need to do? What are the steps that we need to take?
First step is to recognize that we're individuals. Not look at a race, not look at a gender, look at the individual and get to know the individual. I mean, how many times have we walked past people and you speak and then people act just like they haven't seen or heard? You don't exist. And that happens even on, you know, everywhere. But the thing is, get to know someone. You interacting with people, get to know them. Don't see color. Don't see sex. Don't see religious ideas. Get to know the person. And that's what my parents taught us. And I think I'm better off that way because I speak to everybody. I have fun. I have fun. And I can basically deal with anybody unless they're just playing a little bit strange. And when that happens, I just say, oh, okay. And I leave them alone. But I basically can get along with anyone unless they just don't want to and they think I'm a little bit weird, so I don't care. When you reach a certain age, it doesn't matter. Next week, I'll be 70 years old and it doesn't, I don't care. But I'm having a ball because I like to interact with people. I have fun.
Clara Small, thank you very much for being here today. And Teresa Neal, thank you as well. And Don, obviously, great thanks to you for participating today. And thank all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.